I next met with Dr. Sagar Lonial from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University, and he began by discussing key unresolved issues in the management of patients with high-risk multiple myeloma.
I think that there are a couple of questions about management of high-risk myeloma that continue to be an issue. And the first is, should they get maintenance therapy, and what should they get as maintenance therapy? And what we were trying to speak about in that How I Treat paper is really the idea that the standard single-agent lenalidomide as maintenance therapy post-auto is not going to be sufficient for patients with high-risk myeloma. Now, there are series that have looked at single-agent bortezomib from the Dutch, and there is a small experience with bortezomib and thalidomide and dexamethasone. But what we were really highlighting in that paper is data from Dr. Nuka and our group, published in Leukemia 2 years ago, that looks at RVD as maintenance and consolidation for high-risk patients. And so there are really two purposes for that paper. The first is the importance of identifying who the high-risk people are at the time of diagnosis. Because if you miss that opportunity, you're not going to know it until they've relapsed really early. The second is make sure that you're aggressive with their treatment and that you're aggressive in their maintenance as well, because if you do that, you can ultimately improve their long-term outcomes. And that was really the crux of the paper.
Now, when you talk about being, quote, aggressive with their treatment, one of the things that I've heard from a variety of people, including you over the years, is it really doesn't affect that much the upfront induction.
Correct.
It's really more in the longer term and maintenance where you see, you know, more aggressive therapy and particularly the use of proteasome inhibitors. What about transplant strategies in high-risk patients, for example, tandem transplants?
Yeah, so that's a good question. There is some retrospective data from the European groups suggesting that high-risk patients who received a tandem transplant had better long-term outcomes than high-risk who didn't receive a tandem transplant. Again, it's retrospective data, and in our series that I talked about earlier, we didn't actually do tandem transplant, and our outcomes were as good, if not better, than that retrospective series. One important piece that I think is sort of a caveat or a carry-on along with that message that you raised is data presented in the last year hitting on the idea that under-treatment of myeloma in general is a bad thing. And you know I and many others have said two drugs is under-treatment, and so the concept of Lendex as induction therapy is insufficient. Everybody should get the best induction up front. If you under-treat a patient at diagnosis, when they relapse like a high-risk patient. So you've almost converted them by under-treating them to a high-risk phenotype.
Another question, and again, from my simple vision of what you all are doing, it seems like this is really a big question related to maintenance, but in terms of defining who gets put into this high-risk category, you know, usually people think more about cytogenetics and FISH, but you also have a table in this paper talking about disease burden, tumor biology, extramedullary disease. Do these factors, again, change your therapy?
Yeah, so they don't change the therapy on the upfront setting. And I think as you and I have spoken many times, what you do in the first four cycles should be the same and it should be the best. It really changes how you manage the maintenance and the timing of maintenance and the duration of maintenance therapy on the back end. And in addition to FISH and cytogenetics, yes, extramedullary disease at presentation, plasma cell leukemia, these are all important things to keep in mind when you're thinking about identifying a high-risk patient. The other one that's becoming a little bit more used nowadays is gene expression profiling, whether it's one of two different companies, do you use their high-risk signature? That certainly is reasonable, but it's probably not the only answer.
What about immunotherapy? There have been some encouraging reports finally starting to come out about checkpoint antibodies, but it seems like more in combination. What do we know about that, and what about that specifically in the high-risk patient?
Well, I think that's an area of great hope in terms of how to manage high risk. We know that high-risk patients have genomically more unstable myelomas, so they have more deranged intracellular signaling. So targeting them through an immune mechanism may actually be more effective than trying to go after each individual mutation that they may have or acquire over time. The checkpoint inhibitor data is not a single agent home run, if you will, but it is an important combination strategy. And certainly we've anecdotally treated some patients with bad disease who progressed with checkpoint inhibitors and IMIDs and incidentally daratumumab and actually seen some encouraging responses. So I think that there is a role in terms of the cocktail that we use to treat patients, but I don't think it's going to be one target, one antibody, one answer.
I was going to ask you about monoclonal antibodies, daratumumab, as well as elotuzumab with checkpoint inhibitors. Is that being studied in trials?
Yes. I think it's a really neat idea, especially since both of them seem to wipe out myeloid dendritic suppressor cells or activate immune function as well. So I think that combination is going to be really important to test.
Can you talk a little bit about the pragmatics of using RVD maintenance, this strategy that you've talked about with the high-risk patient, and how long you use it and how the patients do?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the pragmatics are that delivery of long-term IV therapy is really untenable. And so what I mean by that is giving IV bortezomib for 3 years is really not a viable option. On the other hand, giving it subcutaneously once a week was a viable option, and that's what we did in that trial experience. What we're now beginning to experiment with to sort of build on that experience is replacing the bortezomib with exasimib. Because again, that then becomes an all-oral combination for high-risk patients that so far has yielded encouraging results.
Yeah, that was really the first thing I thought about when I heard about oral proteasome inhibitors. I knew there was this interest in maintenance. Have you had patients now on, I guess, really exasimib for prolonged periods of time, and how do you find people do?
Yeah, I mean, we were on the original phase one that was published in Lancet Oncology that Shaji Kumar did with IRD up front, followed by maintenance I afterwards. The longest we've had a patient on, I think, was 4.5 years. And that patient, you know, once you get the dose and schedule right early on in the disease course, they do fine after that.
So let's talk about some of the cases that you brought in here today to sort of illustrate how myeloma is being treated, at least in your hands, beginning with your 62-year-old man.
So this was a case of a patient who actually was treated originally on the IFM-DFCI trial. And so he had smoldering for a number of years, converted to symptomatic myeloma with the development of bone lesions, was noted in that original biopsy to have 17p deletion, and received RVD induction, cyclophosphamide mobilization, was randomized to the early transplant arm, and received single-agent lenalidomide as maintenance. And about 14 months after transplant had relapsed.
So before you go on to what happened with this patient, maybe we ought to pick up on a couple of the points. First of all, the trial that the patient was on. Can you talk about what that study looked at and also sort of the companion study from France that has been reported? I think the study he was on has not been reported yet. Is that right?
Correct. That's correct.
So can you talk about what that trial looks at?
So this trial is the U.S. version of a cross-Atlantic trial, the IFM-DFCI trial, in which all patients received RVD induction, and the main study question was early transplantation versus late transplantation. All patients received equal amounts of therapy. All patients in the French version received 1 year of lenalidomide maintenance. In the U.S. version, received lenalidomide maintenance until progression. And what we know from the French version of this trial with limited duration maintenance is that the progression-free survival clearly favored the use of high-dose therapy and transplant. Overall response rate favored high-dose and transplant. Overall survival was similar between the two. Now, you'd asked me earlier about MRD negativity. What's really interesting about this is if you look at patients who achieved 10 to the minus 6 negative MRD, so next-generation sequencing, it didn't matter whether they had a transplant or not, their progression-free and overall survival looked the same. For everybody else, it did appear to favor the use of transplantation, at least the progression-free survival. Overall survival was really short to see follow-up.
And I guess the other thing about that, as you pointed out, the one big difference between the two trials was the maintenance. Do you have any idea when we'll see the North American data? And are you expecting that maybe there's going to be less of a difference because of, you know, the maintenance is more effective?
So, you know, that's a really interesting question. And the trial is just about to complete enrollment, so it'll be a few years before we see the data from that trial presented, just to give reasonable amounts of median follow-up. And I'm a proponent of continuous maintenance in the post-transplant setting. But what I was really struck by was the fact that those patients who achieved 10 to the minus 6 MRD, their outcomes with only 1 year of maintenance was amazing. And that's much better than I would have thought before. And it makes me sort of wonder a little bit about, is there an endpoint at which I would say that's enough in terms of maintenance therapy?
Because I know initially when the maintenance data started coming out, people were saying, well, maybe you don't need to do it with patients who are in complete response. And then I guess there was enough data to support doing it. But now you're talking about the same concept except using MRD as a measure.
Yes. And I think that it's really important data because it may speak not just to quality of life and cost of therapy. I mean, if we're going to talk about quadruplets as induction therapy, in my view, the only way we can make that argument is if we don't give continuous maintenance. If at some point, whether it's 1 year, 18 months, whatever it is, we say patients that have achieved this benchmark, we're stopping therapy. Because otherwise, it's hard to justify the four drugs.
Any reason to believe that some of these people might be cured?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we know before maintenance therapy became the norm that there were about 10 to 15% of patients that were cured after high-dose therapy and transplant. And I'm defining cure as 12 to 15 years post-transplant, continuous complete remission, no maintenance. So the only way we're going to know if that's the case now and if that number has grown is by taking a bit of a leap and seeing how they do.
So before we go on to what happened to this patient next, I am kind of curious because I've always been curious about that study, what it was like giving him the informed consent. And in general, what's it like to say, you know, well, we're either going to do a transplant or not?
So the way that I framed it and the way that I think most of us have framed it is that it's not a yes or no question. It's a when question. And we know from historical trials from the French retrospective data series from our group and others that if you ask the question about timing of transplant, it's hard to show that survival is necessarily impacted. So what I would tell patients is we know that early versus late, at least from the data we have, that the survival looks somewhat similar. And so you're not limiting your survival and you're answering a really important question in the context of how good are these new therapies.
Just out of curiosity, in these studies, these two studies, what fraction of patients are actually getting transplanted on initial relapse?
So in the French analysis, I don't know the answer to that. In our series, everybody that has progressed on the observation arm, the delayed transplant arm, has gone on to a transplant.
And what do you do about maintenance after this sort of delayed transplant? Same approach?
So if they basically, by definition, they've progressed on lenalidomide, if they've progressed in a delayed transplant setting. And so the discussion we have with them is either pomalidomide as maintenance or exasimib as maintenance, going back to something different.
So that's not prescribed in the protocol?
No, protocol stops once they relapse.
As long as we brought this up, we've had a number of cases presented to us by docs in practice of people who had delayed transplant. Here it's part of a trial, but we hear about cases of patients who are reluctant and then they change their mind and then they want to go on to have a transplant. How do you approach the issue of maintenance there when the transplant's occurring down the line? They might have had multiple therapies.
Yeah, I mean, I look to see what treatments they are still sensitive to, and I try and pick something that I can convincingly and that I can give in the long term. You know, giving a medicine once or twice a week intravenously is not a long-term maintenance strategy. And so I try and think about what I can pick amongst their drugs to be able to do that.
So let's get back to this patient. So he goes into the trial, he gets his treatment, and then what happens next?
So he progressed about 14 months out from his auto transplant, and this is somebody we knew had deletion 17P, so it was a significant concern that he's manifesting high-risk disease. We then talked to him at that time point about potential options, including pomalidomide, carfilzomib. Daratumumab was just then beginning to be available at that time point. And so what we ended up doing was treating him on pomalidomide and daratumumab together based on the data that Ajay Chari had presented before.
And how did he do on the therapy? And the first question I have is, how did he do in terms of infusion reaction? We've heard a lot about the infusion reactions with daratumumab. First, how did this man do?
So he had a grade one infusion reaction about 2.5 hours into his infusion and then did fine the rest of the time. We've actually put together a manuscript that's not quite ready yet, but suggests that the use of the leukotriene inhibitor montelukast can reduce the duration and severity of infusion reactions and can actually cut that first infusion by an hour if you give montelukast as part of the initial pre-medication schema.
Now, this is specifically related to daratumumab?
Yes.
How does this agent work and why is it specific to daratumumab?
Well, it's a leukotriene inhibitor, so it's used often in allergic diseases. At least theoretically, some of what happens with daratumumab may be mediated by basophil release because some basophils express CD38, that might be part of it. And so there was a move by the original Dutch group to think about using montelukast. They had some encouraging data. We've got data, I think, on about 90 or 100 patients now that we can show that actually convincingly reduces the severity and shortens the duration of the first infusion.
Has this agent been used to try to prevent infusion reactions with other anti-neoplastics?
Yeah, I think it's been looked at in a number of different sort of anti-inflammatory sort of situations.
Interesting. Maybe there's been a plot looking like this, but I don't know if I've ever seen it. If you were to do sort of a waterfall plot of the time to get the daratumumab in, so to speak, what does it vary from?
So I can tell you, again, I'm trying to remember from that paper we put together, but our average duration for the first infusion was about 7 hours. That's all patients in aggregate. The window is probably somewhere around 10 to 11 for the longest, and the shortest is probably somewhere around 5. So,
you were at a conference we had a couple months ago where somebody brought up the possibility of splitting the daratumumab dose, and particularly where you have infusion centers that are not open as long as, you know, some of the tertiary centers. What do you think about that strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable thing to do. And we have a trial that's looking at upfront daratumumab in newly diagnosed myeloma patients, and that's what was done in that trial. 8 mg/kg given on day 1 and 8 mg/kg given on day 2, and that worked out just fine.
So what happened with this patient? How did he do in terms of response?
So he actually had a great response, went into complete remission after 2 cycles of therapy, and has been in a sustained CR and is now on the once-a-month dosing of daratumumab and doing well.
And how long has it been since he got started on treatment?
He's about 14 months in.
Any tolerability issues at all?
No. I'm actually wondering. I keep asking him, is there something going on you're not telling me about? And there isn't. He's done really well.
Interesting. That's really an amazing story when you think about it, particularly with his adverse cytogenetics that he's done so well. I assume you're going to just keep him on it indefinitely?
Yes. I'm not messing with success.
Any other comments in terms of your observations of the use of daratumumab? Any other issues that you think are important to bring up?
Well, I think it is important, you know, the blood typing issue, I think, is one that people need to be aware of. It causes a false positive indirect Coombs test. And so if your blood bank doesn't know that that patient's had daratumumab, they'll spend days trying to type them. And so we obviously do a type and cross ahead of time in advance. And then we've got a mechanism here now where our blood bank knows when we treat somebody with daratumumab. I think it's really important that your partners, if they're on call covering for you, for instance, and they don't know or they haven't taken care of that patient, that somewhere they know or the patient knows to tell the doctor on call, I got daratumumab, you know, I'm in another hospital far away. Can somebody let their blood bank know? Because we do find from time to time that that communication has not reached out to smaller hospitals. I think it's getting there, but that's something that everybody who's on call should be aware of in case they say, we're having trouble getting blood on this patient.
What's your vision and how do you explain to your fellows the way daratumumab actually works?
So I think daratumumab does a couple of things. I think that interacting with CD38 by itself actually can kill myeloma cells. And so I think it does have the ADCP and ADCC and all those other immune-mediated effects that it has, but I think it also has direct anti-tumor effects. I think the second thing that we've seen that's really very interesting, and it's soft data, it's not hard data, is the fact that it may rewire immune function a little bit. It does eliminate myeloid dendritic suppressor cells. It probably knocks out Tregs as well. And that may make it a perfect partner for something like a checkpoint inhibitor to come in because you've sort of eliminated part of the brakes and then the PD-1 inhibitor comes in and does the rest.
It kind of seems through, I guess, indirect comparisons at this point that maybe the IMiD combinations with daratumumab might be more effective than proteasome inhibitors?
Well, you know, I've believed for a long time that the interaction between an IMiD and an antibody is probably one of the most powerful, potent things we have. And I've got a slide, and I think I may have showed it at the meeting at ASCO together we did together, where you have one drug, one target, 2 different cells, and 2 different effects. And that is, the effects of an IMiD on a myeloma cell are to ultimately kill that myeloma cell. But the effect of that same drug on a T cell or an NK cell is to actually activate that immune cell. And what really strikes that home to me is we've treated a number of patients that are either resistant to POM or DARA or both, with both drugs together. And we've seen at least 30% of patients respond. So I think the idea, as you and I have talked about in the past, the solid tumor, the patient's resistant to a drug, we're going to throw it out. That is not the case with an IMiD antibody combination where you can resensitize because of the immune effects.
So one final question. I keep thinking of more questions I want to ask you, but you know, just sort of pondering that concept you were talking about the best available therapy up front and how are you going to treat them, and the question of carfilzomib versus bortezomib. Obviously, there's a big trial out there trying to look at that. I guess we're not going to know the answer for a while. But I'm kind of curious what your take is right now. And I mean, there was a series of CRD in smoldering myeloma. Do you think that eventually in the next 2-3 years, we're going to be shifting towards using carfilzomib?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my view, and Dr. Rajkumar and I have had many debates about this, you know, I was pushing for triplet versus doublet for 5 years now, and he was waiting on phase 3 data. And so when he comes to me and says, why are you not necessarily supporting carfilzomib with Lendex over bortezomib with Lendex? My answer is that the mechanisms for the triplets are the same. It's still inhibiting a proteasome. It's a similar mechanism of action. And so if we're talking about an incremental benefit of one triplet over another, there I do want to see some additional data, not just on efficacy, but also on safety, because we have a lot of data on sub-Q bortezomib as part of VRD. We don't have a huge amount of data on giving carfilzomib Lendex for newly diagnosed untreated myeloma.
So let's talk about your next case, your 75-year-old man.
So this is a gentleman who came in, he was symptomatic with myeloma, had an early stage ISS1, no high risk features, was diagnosed in his mid to late 60s, underwent standard induction, had a transplant, and was put on single agent lenalidomide maintenance, and had some issues with tolerability, a little bit of diarrhea with lenalidomide maintenance, but got over that, and after about 5 years had progression on single agent len at 5 milligrams a day. At that point, he had very early relapse, so he wasn't truly symptomatic in the sense he didn't have new bone lesions or wasn't anemic, but his protein was about 1.5 grams, 2 grams, somewhere in that ballpark there, and he was clearly moving in the wrong direction. And so we had a discussion of continued observation versus trying to throw something in a little bit early to see whether we could get some more mileage out of lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And what we decided on in this case was to up his lenalidomide, to add dexamethasone and add in elotuzumab. And that was really based on an extrapolation, if you will, from the ELOQUENT-2 trial, because as we know, the ELOQUENT-2 trial, you couldn't have progressed on lenalidomide to get in. And in fact, very few patients in that trial had had prior lenalidomide at all. But we did feel that there's certainly some data suggesting increasing the dose, adding dex to len will make it effective again. And we thought this would be a great opportunity to give elotuzumab an opportunity to work.
And certainly it seems, you know, I first heard about elotuzumab, that was the first thing everybody thought about was this particular scenario. What other common clinical scenarios do you face where you use elotuzumab lenalidomide?
So I think patients that have not had len maintenance with an indolent relapse, this becomes an early choice for me about what to do. I mean, the data was, I think, fairly impressive in terms of the tail on that curve and giving people an opportunity to be on the tail of that curve. The time to next therapy data of over a year, even though the PFS difference was about 4 to 5 months, the time to next therapy difference was over a year, suggesting that you may have reprogrammed the relapse a little bit through the use of an antibody. And the fact that it activates NK cells, immunostimulatory, all those things I think play into potential benefits.
So what's this man's current status? How long has he been on this therapy?
He's been on for 15 months now.
Any tolerability issues?
We did end up backing down on the len again. So we started him at 15 instead of 25 and then got him down to 10. So 10 is about where he settled with some dexamethasone and is doing fine on the every other week LO.
I don't know how often you have to hold the len for whatever reasons, but if you do, do you keep the elotuzumab going?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Interesting. What are some of the scenarios, like cytopenias?
Cytopenias would be the most common reason, and typically we'd hold for either 2 weeks or 4 weeks. So when they're coming back in is when you restart the therapy.
Where are things right now in terms of trials looking at new uses of elotuzumab? It seems like the obvious thing would be to add it to len and maintenance.
Yeah, so those trials are ongoing in Germany. The German study group has a large randomized trial looking at Len versus Len-Elo in the upfront therapy setting. There's also the Eloquent One trial, which is Elo-Len-Dex versus Len-Dex for newly diagnosed myeloma. And I think, to me, the other area of significant interest is going to be with POM. So what do we know about POM plus Elo? There's no reason to think it wouldn't be effective. What's the magnitude of benefit? What's the response rate? All those kinds of things with the more potent IMiD, I think, are really interesting. And again, partnering with PD-1, those trials are actually early in their progress now, combining with Nivo and pomalidomide.
So Nivo, pomalidomide, and Elo?
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds interesting and expensive. So let's go on to your next case, the 57-year-old lady.
So this is a lady who has had a number of prior therapies and was transplanted about 8 years ago, did well on Len maintenance, progressed, and then received Pomdera as sort of second salvage, but had not had a proteasome inhibitor for a long period of time. And in this patient, we elected to go with a carfilzomib-panobinostat combination because those were the two sort of novel agents that she hadn't been exposed to as yet. We based that carfilzomib-panobinostat concept on three trials that were done looking at carfilzomib and panobinostat. And one of the points that I like to make when I talk about panobinostat is all that's made of its GI toxicity, the diarrhea, the nausea, is when it's partnered with IV bortezomib, which is what the Panorama trial really did. We don't really do that anymore. And it turns out, if you look at adverse event profiles side by side for trials looking at single agent panobinostat, panobinostat with IV bortezomib, and then the carfilzomib panobinostat trials, the GI toxicity drops markedly once you get it away from IV bortezomib.
Could I just ask why?
Well, I think bortezomib does have a little bit more GI tox than carfilzomib.
Wow.
And so I think you get some synergistic GI toxicity when you put the two drugs together.
Huh.
And so there were three different phase one, phase two trials combining CAR and PAN, one from Jatin Shah, one from Jonathan Kaufman at our place, and one from Jesus Berdeja at Sarah Cannon. And all of them showed the ability to overcome proteasome inhibitor resistance with a much lower GI toxicity incidence. And so
when you say IV bortezomib, I assume you include sub-Q bortezomib.
No, the Panorama trial didn't use sub-Q. It only used IV.
So you're thinking maybe sub-Q bortezomib would not have the GI toxicity?
I don't think it'll be as bad, and that trial is being done now. That's the Panorama 3 trial, comparing bortezomib dex versus bortezomib dex panobinostat with sub-Q dosing of bortezomib. So we'll know what that looks like. It may be less, but clearly there's a component of GI toxicity that comes from adding it to IV bortezomib.
So this patient gets carfilzomib, pan, and dex, and what happened?
She actually had a great response, and we've actually seen that not only patients with refractory disease have had good responses to this combination, but that the CAR-PAN combination seems to be effective in some patients with extramedullary disease. So that really bad myeloma that comes up as lumps and bumps, you can sometimes get responses with carfilzomib and panobinostat together.
But now, was this patient refractory to a proteasome inhibitor?
No. They hadn't received a proteasome inhibitor for several years, but no, they were not refractory.
So I'm just trying to think of why you would, this was on a trial or off trial?
Off trial.
So why wouldn't you just give carfilzomib, let's say POM and dex? Well, she had POM, I guess.
She had POM, yeah. So she'd progressed on POM, progressed on Len. And again, based on our experience with being able to keep people on longer, that's why we chose carfilzomib over bortezomib.
How much of a benefit realistically in your own mind, not so much from the trials, but when you're looking at a patient, how much of an increase in benefit do you see by adding the panobinostat? Are you convinced it's clinically meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, we were able to overcome bortezomib resistance in the trials that we did. Both us and Berdeja was able to overcome bortezomib resistance through the carfilzomib-panobinostat combination. So I think there is some benefit there. And if you can do it in a dose and schedule that are more tolerable, you can keep patients on for longer. And so one of the take-homes is we don't use three times a week panobinostat 3 weeks in a row with 1 week off like you do the carfilzomib. We give the panobinostat week one and week three with 3 weeks in a row of carfilzomib. So that 1 week in the middle really seems to make a difference.
So you seem convinced, and the data seems convincing, that it's helpful in patients who are refractory to a proteasome inhibitor, but yet this patient wasn't, and yet you still used it.
Yeah. I mean, because we believe in triplets the whole way, so we weren't going to do carfilzomib alone. And again, for a toxicity issue, we didn't want to partner the panobinostat with bortezomib.
Just out of curiosity, what would this patient's next therapy be?
We're going to find a phase one.
I guess the patient has not had ELO, technically.
Yeah, although again, ELO's best efficacy is in partnership with LEN, and this patient's resistant to LEN, so the likelihood you're going to get much benefit is much lower.
Let's go on to your next patient, the 75-year-old woman.
So she actually was a delightful lady that came to us from the southern part of the state, lived about 3 hours away. And one of the things that we learned about her was during her transplant process, the travel back and forth between there and us was a bit of a challenge. So when we got her to a maintenance with single agent lenalidomide, you know, for a month or two, she did well, but then she just decided she didn't want to be on maintenance therapy. She didn't want to come see us that often. And so she went about 18, probably closer to 2 years, unmaintained after an auto transplant, and then developed not just biochemical relapse, but progressive anemia, causing us to want to try and get her started on salvage therapy. She'd received RVD as her initial therapy and did well, but did have a little bit of neuropathy with the bortezomib, which is now down to just minimal grade one. And so for her, being able to not have to come into the office very often was an important part of the decision-making process for her, at least when she had the opportunity to make that decision. And so when we went through the menu of potential treatment options for her, the all-oral combination of exasimib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone was the option she really wanted, she favored.
And how is she doing? What's her current status?
Yeah, she's about 6 months in now and has achieved a VGPR. She's tolerating therapy well. We're beginning to dial down her dex. She is 75 years old, and so keeping them on 40 milligrams of dex once a week can be a little bit challenging, but she's coming up once a month and seeing us and doing okay.
And any GI toxicity, and what have you observed in general in terms of exasimib in terms of side effects?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the upfront setting, we've seen some GI toxicity that actually is mitigated by the dex, which seems to help a little bit. In the maintenance setting, when we've tried to use it there at full dose, we've had a little bit of trouble giving 4 milligrams at the very beginning. But if you start with 3 for a couple cycles and then work your way up, you can get to 4 without significant issues. Most of the skin rash and nausea that was seen at the higher doses of exasimib. So at the dose that was settled on now, the fixed dose, it's a much lower incidence.
What's been reported and what have you observed in terms of peripheral neuropathy with exasimib?
So it's there. I won't say that it's zero, but the best example I have is somebody on the phase one with exasimib who had grade 3 neuropathy from bortezomib, and I really had to sit down with her over and over again when I said this is the cousin of bortezomib to get her on the trial, but she did, and she never had any further neuropathy and was on for over 4 years. So if you have it with one, you're not going to have it necessarily with the other, and while it's there, it's probably about 20% all neuropathy with exasimib, most of it grade 1. Very, very little grade 3 at all.
Some other papers that you've been involved with that I wanted to ask you about. We've been hearing a lot of exciting things about venetoclax, particularly in CLL, really interesting in terms of the tumor lysis syndrome, et cetera. And I was surprised to see a couple of publications that you were involved with. One interesting title, dexamethasone treatment promotes BCL2 dependence in myeloma and sensitivity to venetoclax. And then another paper targeting glutamine metabolism in myeloma enhances BIM binding to BCL2. You know, where are we in terms of BCL2 and agents like venetoclax in myeloma?
Yeah, so you've really been digging deep in the myeloma literature to find those papers.
got to find the good stuff, you know?
So I think the story about BCL2 in myeloma is that 85% of myeloma patients or their cells are MCL1 dependent, which means they're going to be intrinsically resistant to BCL2 inhibitors. That leaves about 15% of patients who are actually BCL2 dependent. And it turns out that a majority of them are 11-14 translocation patients. So patients that look more B-cell-like than the average myeloma patient. They tend to express CD20. They do all the things that looks more B-cell-like. So what those two papers really are trying to do is figure out how do you take that 15% and increase it. And so one of the strategies that Dr. Boies really employs is the idea of adding dexamethasone, not because dex kills myeloma, but because dex pushes cells towards BCL2 dependence. And that's the same thing that the other paper on glutamine dependence also does. It pushes cells towards BCL2 dependence. And once you make them BCL2 dependent, you have a shot at them with ABT-199.
And have clinical responses been observed with venetoclax and myeloma?
Yeah, we have. And I think if you look at everybody, it's going to be a disappointing number. But if you look at the subset that are enriched amongst the 1114, it's quite striking what they're. It's about 40 to 45% single agent response rate in those patients. And just as an example, there's a patient, she's a young lady that lives up in Pittsburgh and has seen pretty much anything you can imagine. Bortezomib, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, pomalidomide, bendamustine, melphalan, transplant, cyclophosphamide, seen it all, was basically being sent for supportive care, knew somebody in Athens, Georgia that we take care of, came down and saw us, got put on ABT-199, has been in a complete remission now for 2 years with single agent ABT-199. And it was all predicted from the laboratory studies.
In her?
In her, yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, we took her sample and tested it. She was one of the most sensitive ones we had.
So we've been talking about a number of new approaches. Certainly have been a lot of new things happening already in terms of myeloma. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about was CAR T therapy. You know, we hadn't really seen very much, and then now it sounds like we're starting to see a little bit. What do we know about that in myeloma?
So we know that when you use CD19 as a target, which is what was published from the Penn group, you may get a few responses, but they're not long, durable responses. There was that one case report that suggested the patient had been cured, but it turns out that that patient ultimately relapsed and has actually been treated with an antibody since then and has done well again. I think that, in my view, the real issue with CAR T cells is there a better target than CD19? And I think that there are a couple of candidates. CD38 obviously is one that people are interested in. The one to me that's the best is BCMA, and the NIH group has tested a CAR T cell against BCMA. The response rate looked pretty good. We don't know about response duration. The cytokine release syndrome continues to be an issue amongst patients receiving the highest dose of therapy. And I guess in my view, CAR T cells are important, they're clearly effective, and they will be a way that we treat many diseases down the road. We are also beginning to develop BiTEs in myeloma, the bispecific antibodies. So CD3 partnered with BCMA or CD3 partnered with CD38. These, I think, will offer similar efficacy to what we see with the CAR T cells. And the advantage of the BiTE, in my view, will be that it's an off-the-shelf preparation. You don't have to go through all this process of making a cell, finding problems with the manufacturing process. With a BiTE, you pull it off the shelf and you give it.
And I guess the only agent I'm aware of that right now has that technology is blinatumomab, mainly in ALL. Is that the only one we have right now?
Well, there are phase ones now in myeloma looking at CD38 and BCMA as BiTEs, separate from blinatumomab.
You mentioned off the shelf, and I've hearing sort of things about off-the-shelf CAR T cells.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very early days with that. Allogeneic CAR T cells are being proposed where there's an off-the-shelf mechanism. I think that in some ways that may lose the potential advantage of a CAR T cell, which is that if you're going to be successful in the long term, you want those cells to hang around for a long time to give you immunosurveillance. If it's an allo cell, it may not have that ability to do that.